Okay, gentle listener, what you just missed before the podcast went to air was one of the loudest belches I've ever heard come out of the mouth of Greg Wyshynski. Now, Greg, was that from something you consumed after the game on Saturday, or perhaps something you consumed at the Mets-Yankees game on Sunday, before, after, or maybe even during? How was your weekend, bro?
Our pitching and their hitting, the New York Jets would be a juggernaut amongst juggernauts. Oh, thanks, my goodness. Yeah, where would they play? They'd probably have to play in Brooklyn. We'd split the difference. That was probably White Castle. That's probably White Castle that would have contributed to it. I had five sliders and some fries on the way back from Jersey. Yeah, because I was up in New Jersey. What I did was I went to a Met-Yankee game on Sunday. My friend and I went to the Jim Beam Club, got some brews, got some free popcorn, sat in the seats. Got a little lit, talked about the game. I don't know anything about the Mets anymore. I just kind of go to goof on my team and then root against the Yankees. So if that makes me bandwagon, what have you. Saturday was interesting. Saturday I actually covered this thing called Game 5 the Stanley Cup Final. Yeah, it's interesting.
Refresh my screen here for a second. What's Game 5 all about?
Well, Game 5 is interesting. Like, so what happened was this team from Los Angeles they got out to a 3-0 lead on the three-time Stanley Cup champion New Jersey Devils. And there was a lot of concern that maybe the Devils were actually going to lose this series, which is preposterous when you think about the history of these teams. The Devils growing their own legacy, the Kings borrowing theirs from Edmonton and then Philadelphia. So basically what happened was the Devils realized a little late that the series had started. They won Game 4, they won Game 5 in quite convincing fashion. And now what's going to happen to this series, it's kind of stunning when you think about it. Not only are the Kings looking at the inevitable loss in the Stanley Cup Final and seeing New Jersey raise hockey's holy grail over its collective head, but they will also be looking at becoming a footnote in history, becoming one of the most embarrassed, shamed teams in the history of playoff hockey by allowing an opponent to come back from a 3-0 deficit to then win a series. In fact, Jeff Merrick, I don't believe this is I don't know if the stats actually been put out there yet. I don't believe this has happened since 1942.
Correct. It was the Jack Adams coached and general managed Detroit Red Wings. And actually, it was we've talked about this before. Jack Adams, after Game 4, actually went out onto the ice and punched a referee in the face. That referee's name in question was Mel Harwood.
And this is, I mean, just to put it in context, on how long it's been since this happened. 1942, no Americans in the NHL. Not a single one. It was a segregated league.
I don't think you're right about that, but you can continue.
So what we're looking at as we enter Game 6 of this series on Monday night is the continuation of the inevitable. I mean, obviously, you know, look at the Devils roster, and it's filled with heroes. Adam Henrique and Patrick Eliash, Zach Parise, Ilya Kovalchuk playing through pain, Marty Brodeur turning back the clock and at 40 years old outplaying the guy that everybody thinks should have won the Vezina this year. It's a team full of heroes. It's a likable team trying to thwart the advances of an inferior opponent as they try to win what I've been told by the Los Angeles sports media is the Hockey Award.
The Hockey Award?
That's what I heard, yeah. Yeah.
The Marvel Comics Award, the Stan Lee Cup. Is that essentially
it's
what
their no prize.
It is named
yes,
after
no
the
prize.
The guy. Oh, okay, very good. Well, they've only won two games, you wish. Although, you know, in one of the great lines over the weekend, I can't remember who wrote it, it was the New Jersey Devils lead the series 2-3. And that's kind of what it feels like right now, isn't it? Like, momentum has completely shifted the other way. Now, mind you, if you look at Game 4, Voyanov and Kopitar, what do they have in common? Oh, yeah, both hit the post. And then if you look at Game 5, it was Williams and Stoll's turn to ring the post.
Well, I think what you're trying to say,
both games.
What you're trying to say, Merrick, is that momentum is a fickle mistress.
What I'm trying to say is you're supposed to come back with something cheeky like, oh, Marty's supposed to stop the shots that go wide now too, or something like that whenever a goalpost comes into question.
I don't need to be cheeky about this. We both know the inevitability of this series is the New Jersey Devils winning in seven games. We all know this now. There's not even Game 6 and go to Game 7 so we can get this over with. It's been a long season, man.
just stayed in New Jersey and said, all right, we'll wait until Wednesday and heal everybody
exactly.
up and we'll just play.
Exactly. You know, save on airfare, save on fuel costs, stay in New Jersey and concede victory to the Devils in Game 6. I think you hit the nail
on the head,
sir.
Is this part of the Andrew Ferentz Green Program or the NHL? Let's just play the one game and save everyone the air tax, for crying out loud. Let's save everyone the green tax. It comes down to a couple of things, and maybe only one thing, and it seemed really tiny and small and maybe innocuous, but when you look back on it, maybe it was the most profound move that Peter DeBoer has made. Henrik Tillander. And the minute that Henrik Tillander went back in the lineup, all of a sudden, you have Bryce Salvador playing with Anton Volchenkov, you have Henrik Tillander playing with Merritt Siglicki, and everything on that blue line, as Radiohead once sang, everything in its right place. The defense just fits now for New Jersey.
I wrote about that earlier today in a much less partisan piece. The things that have gone right for the Devils and the things that have gone wrong for the Kings. And the Tillander thing reset the defense. If you look, he and Zidlicky have been playing together against the Carter, Penner, Richards line and been doing a hell of a job against them in the last few games. DeBoer's not made many missteps in these playoffs. Like, most of the buttons he's pushed have worked. His biggest misstep, and the Devils would be maybe in a completely different situation now had this been the case, was not putting Tillander in Game 3 and not putting Sikora in Game 3. It was nonsensical to drop two games at home, go back to L.A., and not make any lineup changes. I just don't get that. So then he makes the lineup changes in 4, and they've all worked so far. But, again, your theory is pretty good. Here are some other theories why the Kings are eventually going to lose the series. One, their mascot is terrible. Bailey is cliche. Oh, a lion who is a king. You can connect those dots pretty easily. And also completely derivative of the Sacramento Kings mascot, who I think we all know is better and more talented. Also because Dustin Brown's beard looks like something you would find in the no-no on a Swedish prostitute. And I think that's very distracting for people when they skate with Dustin Brown.
Hey, as an aside, you know what I discovered over the weekend? You know the Manamana song from Sesame Street?
Uh-huh.
Because my oldest son, TJ, is obsessed with that song. You know, do-do-do-do-do. You know where it comes from?
Manamana. Where does it come from?
A Swedish porn. There's a Swedish softcore porn film with that. That's where Jim Henson got
origin,
it from.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. All right, carry on.
The third reason is that our coach, and by ours I mean the Devils, because I'm obviously a homer. Our coach is personable and funny and flirtatious. He likes boobs. And the opposing coach...
He has no choice.
The opposing coach sounds like Carl Spackler on lithium. And I don't think that his team is very motivated by some guy getting up there and being like, can't believe we're missing farm day for this final.
Hang on a second. I want to back up.
I like it. You know, it's like a big picnic. You take the drinks to the picnic. You know what I'm saying?
What are you doing? You don't bring a ham sandwich to a church picnic. What's wrong with you?
No, you don't.
Farm day. I want to go back to Peter DeBoer and the boobs. We're gonna get there eventually.
Okay.
Let's get it over with.
Bounce back to it. All right.
Bounce back. Bing, bing, bing. Follow the bouncing ball. Back to Taylor Stevens, who will be behind the bench tonight, right behind Peter DeBoer.
Behind the Devil's bench, by the way. She wants the cups as close to the cup champs as possible.
Wow, that's nice little. And there are two settings, dormant and erect. We've mentioned that before. She was on Hockey Central today, by the way, and I think you can find that over at fan590.com. Should be in the archive. Interesting interview with Darren, Nick, and Doug. But it's not that he likes boobs, okay? We don't know that. It's like saying, as a human being on Earth, you like the moon. It's just there. You have no choice. It's not as if Peter DeBoer can will them away. The moons will be behind him. It doesn't matter. Like, they're there, right?
So you're ascribing to the gravitational pull theory, because there's two theories out there about what he did when he saw the boobs, because he took two giant steps to his left, like he was playing Simon Says. Uh-huh. It's one is that they're so large they have their own gravity, and therefore satellites circulate around them, and Peter DeBoer was just naturally attracted to them, almost like a piece of metal and a magnet. He saw these gigantic jugs and then wanted to get closer to them. Now, I'm a kind of, listen, by no means I am no scientist. I believe the first one versus the second one, but I really think that's an argument between faith and science.
We'll leave that one between the scientists and the theologists. Okay, let's leave that alone then.
Right.
You know what I really appreciated from the last game? And this sort of dovetails into our question of the day, Wyshynski, which is, what's your fave comeback of the season so far? I love moments that remind me of the past. You know me. I'm stuck. I can't get out of the past. You know this about me by now.
You are. You're very
stuck
in the past. By the way, Bernie Perrant on the show today.
Hey, Bernie! Not only are we going to talk about the three by the trophies and the mask in 1971, but Greg and I are going to dial it all the way back to the Memorial Cup in 1965. Yes, indeed. Check it. We're going all the way back. It's not oldies. It's classic. Here's what I love. My fave comeback of the year. My fave comeback of the year is the two-pad stack. And God bless Marty Brodeur. It's the new butterfly. We've gone all the way full circle now because the butterfly is essentially just cover the bottom of the net, in snap fashion form. And isn't that what the two pad stack has been doing now to the Los Angeles? Like, he's stung how many guys? About four or five different guys with the two pad stack because you just don't see it coming. And the timing of it has to be so perfect that it's one of the hardest things to pull off in today's game because the answer is, well, go high, stupid, because he's giving you the whole top of the net. But he does it normally when, you know, and goaltenders, Bernie will talk about this, you read the angle of the blade, and if the blade is open, you know he's going high, and if the blade is closed, you know the shot's coming in low, and that's when he can read it fast and go to the two-pad stack. So that, to me, Greg Wyshynski, is my favorite comeback of the year, the two-pad stack.
My favorite comeback of the year was Jaromir Jagr. I just love the fact that he came back to the NHL. I loved the Jagr watch last summer. I loved what he was able to do on the line with Giroux and Hartnell, becoming one of the best lines in hockey, making Giroux a star player who was going to probably be on the cover of a video game. So Jagr is my favorite comeback. My second favorite comeback is Jonathan Quick's inability to win in the playoffs. It's been what he is a guy for the last couple of years who couldn't win in the playoffs. He was a liability. I mean, I think there was a strong groundswell for Jonathan Bernier to get that position as starting goaltender for the Kings because Quick couldn't win the big game. And so I'm very excited that's made a comeback now, beginning in Game 4, into Game 5, undoubtedly into Game 6, and then Game 7 where he will sit idly by and watch Marty Brodeur raise the cup for the Devils.
At which point, if your fantasy comes true, oh, look at that. It's like Ferris Bueller's Day Off on a cloud in the sky. Nine times, Mrs. Bueller. What country do you think this is? All the classics for Greg Wyshynski today.
I want to point out something important about this too, about this series that I don't think has really been referenced enough. I have it on good authority that Dustin Penner has a meth lab in his beard. That he's been illegally producing crystal meth throughout this series in his beard. It's one of the reasons why he's hit the skids offensively, the pressure of it. I mean, anybody who's seen Breaking Bad knows that there's a lot of pressure around making meth and keeping it on the down low. He's got a meth lab in his beard. And once it'll all come to light.
Where's Dustin Brown keeping it? Because he's been pretty invisible this series.
I don't know where he's keeping it.
And in the last couple of games specifically, he's just been pounded by Anton Volchenkov. Like, relentlessly. So I'm saying, man, like Talinder comes back, and all of a sudden Volchenkov's, you know, he's back on the right side playing with Salvador, and he's just dropping everyone on the left wing. It's fantastic.
Yeah. No, Brown said this has been a much more physical series than he thought it was going to be.
But only the last two games. But that's the thing. Like first three games, LA had a free pass.
They were just
turnstiling the Devils. See ya. I'm going around ya. Later. Slip. Like, that's what it was.
Don't you understand that after the Devils thwarted the New York Rangers, God's work, as we call it, they needed a few games to get their gear in order. They needed to get into game shape again after that incredibly, incredibly intense, laborious series. I mean, the LA Kings basically have had a cakewalk to the final. They've not had a tough game at all. It's been like an exhibition season. The Devils have played real teams. We're talking potential champions, the Rangers, the Flyers, the Florida Panthers.
Yeah.
And it
wasn't like LA knocked off teams 1, 2, and 3.
No.
Oh. Okay.
It's like they've knocked off like the B teams. Vancouver? Oh, come on, man. Honestly.
Who'd they beat? They beat the Hershey Bears. They beat the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins.
Right.
They beat the Milwaukee Admirals. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And the Korean women's team is the third team that they beat. The Devils played real hockey teams. The Kings played a bunch of people that were laying down the welcome mat for them.
Null Neil tweets in, hashtag MVSW, fave comeback, Wyshynski's homerism. It's been a while. As bad as you are today, how insufferable were you on Sunday at the Mets game?
As a Mets fan?
No, as a New Jersey Devils fan. Like, how?
Oh,
okay,
there's,
I know
there's no crossover there. There's no cross.
No?
You have to understand that there's no hockey crossover into a baseball stadium. There'd be football crossover between Jets and Giants fans were that, you know, the two sports happening concurrently. But there's no hockey crossover. And it's funny, somebody tried to mock, I want to say it was Deadspin, tried to mock Devils fans by saying that it's a bunch of people from New Jersey and Staten Island and nobody else that cares about the series. There's more Devils fans in Manhattan than there are in Staten Island. I mean, you know,
is that true?
Lambert wrote about the ratings today again on Puck Daddy, and the ratings obviously for the series haven't been good. I think they're going to get better starting tonight. I think if the Devils can actually push this thing to 7, we're actually going to see a pretty considerable number on Wednesday night to see if history could be made. But you know, the Devils are a problematic team because not only is the fan base not elephantine, and not only do they not have a national fan base on the level of a Flyers team or a Chicago or Detroit or Pittsburgh or somebody like that, but they also defeated the Flyers and defeated the Rangers on the way to the Cup final, and I don't think either of those fan bases give a shit about watching this team try to win the Cup. I think they're done with the playoffs, personally. And I think that factors into there not being a large audience to watch them.
What is the best market for sticking with it, do you think? Like, give me the because by and large in Canada, everyone just follows it regardless. Like, it softens.
Okay.
But it's very rare that if they don't watch it, at least they know what's going on and can follow the series, and they know that tonight, hey, Marty Brodeur's been a story, and we're headed to Game 6 in Los Angeles. Whether they watch the game or not, at least everyone is aware of it. Most hockey fans are aware. All hockey fans are aware of it in Canada specifically, even if they don't watch. But you're right, the numbers have softened in Canada specifically. CBC will not, and this is interesting, CBC will not release the numbers for the games until the finals are over, until all games are complete. Then they'll release the number. I think that's because they don't want to make the number part of a headline in Canada because it has softened. But you can't really meet anyone in Canada that doesn't know what's going on in the series. But what's it like in the States? Like, what's it like stateside? Which markets stick with it, by and large?
Buffalo sticks with it every year.
They do, every year. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. They really do.
Okay.
I forget what the other local... Pittsburgh usually sticks with it, too.
Okay.
You know, the cities in the Northeast usually stick with it. I mean, you get like anomalies.
Does Boston stick with it?
I don't know what their number is this year. I forget what they've done traditionally. I mean, last year they carried the final. New England carried the final. So,
would you say that for the NHL, for best case scenario from a ratings point of view, it's either Boston or New York against either Chicago or Detroit?
No, not at all, because I think Pittsburgh and Philly are both in that conversation too. Any original six team, Pittsburgh, Philly, they're both in there. I think if Buffalo was in the final, the ratings would be strong based on their regional ratings and then ratings throughout the Northeast. I think there are some teams that can deliver ratings. The argument that I've been having a lot over the last couple of weeks is with people that are asking me about the regional versus local thing that Vince Doria, who's the VP of whatever the hell for ESPN, brought up a few months ago. You know, is hockey a regional sport? Is that why it shouldn't get coverage on ESPN? And, you know, he wasn't completely wrong. In a lot of ways, you need a strong regional base of viewership in order to pull a great national rating in the Stanley Cup final. But he wasn't completely right either, because I think that you can have series that transcend that regionality. And I think last year's is the great example. You know, it's not as if the entirety of the United States is watching to see if the Boston Bruins can win the Stanley Cup. But they did, after it became apparent that there was biting and stretchers and bad guys and good guys. So it all comes back to, and this is going to be familiar to anybody who's read the blog in the last couple weeks. It all comes back to the familiar tropes of what gets sports fans to watch sports. And it's the big Joseph Campbell-esque themes, heroes, heroes' quests, villains, adversity, obstacles, controversy. You know, you just need a series that has that.
And so what you're saying
it may not necessarily matter that it's you need. Here's what you need: you need big themes, you need a little controversy, and you need at least one team to be of that original six, Philly, Pittsburgh, or a team on a ridiculous drought kind of thing. Which in theory should have been L.A., but L.A. is an anomaly because no one will respect those fans not having ever seen a cup because they have the Lakers.
What you're saying then is it's pro wrestling. That's what you need. Because what you're describing is what pro wrestling attempts to deliver on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis.
Yeah,
by the way,
someone to carry the match and someone to put fannies in seats.
Yeah. And as an aside too, I know we've had different conversations about, you know, the language that we use on this program, Stanley Cup Final versus Stanley Cup Finals.
Oh, come on.
Have we had the Original Six conversation before?
No, what is that?
How can you call it the Original Six when the NHL started in 1917, there were four teams? Well, actually, then it went down to three because the Wanderers rink burnt down after six games. So they were out of the league. Can we stop? It's a pet peeve of mine.
And so what do you want to call it?
The NHL and the six-team era. Just the word original just is so funny.
The NHL in the six-team era? You'd like to name... The Original Six would be known as that?
Something akin to that. in the six-team era of the NHL. Because really, it should be the original four. Two Montreal teams, Toronto and Ottawa.
You're looking live at a sold-out Boston Arena, where tonight the Bruins and the Leafs battle each other in a matchup of teams that were sub the six, that were before or after the four, that are now the six, and they are not original, but they are founding teams. Live here on Versus.
We haven't massaged the language of it yet, but doesn't the term Original Six kind of...
No.
Not sit well with you? No?
They're not the original
six.
It doesn't matter to me. It's a moniker of great renown. It's a moniker of great honor.
Why don't we just say the original 12 and just call it, you know, the 1967-68 team, the post-expansion NHL. That's the original 12.
Merrick's the guy who's like founding fathers. One of them was childless. All right. With that, we will start the show proper, shall we?
How do you take an escalator down?
Sportsnet.
That's a hockey, you know. It's only a game. Why do you have to be mad?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Sabine is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Canuck fan in San Francisco wonders, somehow I see Jeff Merrick wearing a "you know what grinds my gears" shirt during this podcast.
I'm actually wearing, because I just went out for a run, and it is blistering hot again in Toronto.
Yeah, it's hot here in D.C. too.
It's
brutal.
I'm wearing tiny little gym shorts, and actually I've got a, you'll love this Wish, a Tom Brady jersey on.
Oh, God. My kryptonite.
It's my go-to in the summer because it's all nice and mesh and cool. I got a nice breeze coming in from the fan in my office here.
Can I just mention right now, by the way, like, again, as you know, if you listen to the podcast, we do our own thing. We are part of the Sportsnet family, but we're not on Sportsnet 590. Taylor Stevens is going on with Tim and Sid this afternoon.
She was just on with Hockey Central. Holy smoke, she gets around. Every show's got to have some. Really?
Are you saying that if you proposition Taylor Stevens that she does not turn down said proposition, sir?
She shows up on Primetown with McCowan. I'm out. I'm checking out. That's just it.
So, Taylor Stevens on the air with us. Ample bosoms. Ample bosoms, ma'am.
The upcoming expiration of the collective bargaining agreement would dictate perhaps an influx of NHL players, at least in the short term, to the KHL. Taylor, agree or disagree?
Source told me this morning, Sidney Crosby's contract could be anywhere between 6 years, 9 years, or the circumference of our next guest's bosoms.
Yeah.
Oh. Craig McTavish returns to the Edmonton Oilers, sir.
Yeah, not unexpected. People around Camp McTavish have been saying to people in Edmonton that Craig's on his way back.
Camp McTavish.
So, well, you know, people in and around Craig McTavish. I don't want to come out and say family members or anything like that. But
nobody wears any helmets. They just run around.
Yeah, Camp McTavish. Yeah, the leader's coming back. And you know what? It's interesting because he comes in as a senior VP of hockey operations. Now, the last VP of hockey operations and head scout, was Kevin Pendergast, who's now with Hockey Canada. That place, that position was never filled. So you could say, okay, Mac, he's coming out, coming in, you know, back to the Oilers fold, and he's essentially taking Pendergast's position. But I do wonder, and maybe we'll get some clarification at the press conference today. Maybe Mark Spector can shed some light on this, being as tuned in to the Oilers as he is. I just wonder how this is all going to work with Steve Tambling, he's a general manager, Kevin Lowe above him, and then in between those two, all of a sudden, Craig McTavish, who, as we know, is still very much in favor by Kevin Lowe, and also still very much and highly thought of by the owner, Dale Cates. And we should recall, too, it wasn't as if Craig McTavish was fired as the head coach of the Edmonton Oilers, technically. He said, every coach has a shelf life, and that's it for me.
It's one of those things where, like, they both kind of came together and said,
but
okay, it's time to move on.
Did the owner want him to leave?
No, Cates actually texted a radio station around that time to say he's staying, and then 2 days later he was there was a parting of the ways. But, you know, I've read a couple of different takes on this, and one from Dave Staples of the Edmonton Journal is that this is like Men in Black. This is Tommy Lee Jones selecting Will Smith to be his successor. This is Kevin Lowe selecting his good buddy to maybe be his successor in the front office should Kevin Lowe decide to move on. But I prefer the other theory, which is that this is giving Craig McTavish a running start in management for the Edmonton Oilers in case shit hits the fan and they have to scapegoat Tambellini next year despite the extension. And it would be a scapegoating, because do you get the sense that you bring in McTavish to work under Lowe, that Tambellini's influence in this organization is tantamount
weakened
to an advisory role?
It's been weakened. I think it's been weakened. And now I think if you're Steve Tambellini, you have to start looking over your shoulder a little bit. And you know what, Tuish? Whether it's Brent Sutter, and I kind of don't think that it will be. I think it'll be Ralph Kruger. But whomever the new head coach of the Edmonton Oilers is, doesn't he already have to look over his shoulder as well? Because to your point, there's someone who's being groomed for a general manager position, essentially, with the Oilers organization. And there's someone who does have a strong coaching background, not just with the Oilers, but elsewhere as well. And last year, listen, it was pretty obvious to everybody that Craig McTavish was the coach of the Chicago Wolves, which is the American Hockey League affiliate to the Vancouver Canucks, for one very specific reason. In case things fell apart with Vancouver and they had to fire Alain Vigneault, they had a coach in waiting. Speaking of in waiting, our first guest is there. From Sportsnet, here's our good friend Mark Spector to talk about the Stanley Cup Final and also the goings-on in Edmonton today. Spec, how are you, sir?
Doing very well. Surprising little nugget of news out of Edmonton today.
Yeah, but not too unexpected, is it, Spec?
Well, I didn't think that Craig McTavish was. I mean, I just heard your lead in, and I think you're deadly correct when you say that it was. You know, he was hoping that he'd be in place for that Vancouver job if Vigneault didn't work out. But I think that he just wants to be a hockey coach. He wants to be an NHL hockey coach, and I think what we've seen here, gentlemen, is, you know, the jobs have come and gone or are still open in Edmonton, Calgary, Washington, Montreal, Columbus this year. And I'm going to make the assumption here that Craig McTavish wasn't going to get any of them and said to himself, man, another year shut out of the coaching ranks. Maybe it's time to get back to Edmonton where I want to be. And maybe it's time to get into upper management where perhaps my future lies.
You know, from an outsider's perspective, doing this move with McTavish would seem to contradict giving Steve Tambellini a contract extension. Does Daryl Cates just have too much money?
Well, I've got to say this. If Daryl Cates ran his pharmaceutical business the way he runs his hockey team, he might not have that problem of having too much money. You know, I'll tell you what, I mean, let's say what everybody's saying or thinking right now. This is another recycled Edmonton guy coming back who, outside of one, you know, splashy run in 06, this group of Kevin Lowe and McTavish, and now Daryl Cates is the owner, and Steve Tambellini, throw him in there, they haven't accomplished anything in Edmonton since they were players in the 80s. So you can hire whoever you want, but the time has to come now where either they hit phase two of this rebuild, which has been verbally promised by Tambellini, or if they continue to struggle, you got to say, why are we bringing the same people back and continuing to struggle all the time?
And does that mean that now, more so than ever, here they are, this is Quebec Nordiques territory, first overall draft pick, three seasons in a row, knowing that, you know, back to your point, that the time is now for the Edmonton Oilers to actually do something and not just sell hope, but start to sell wins, that Steve Tambellini maybe isn't married to that first overall draft pick?
No, he's married to it. I think you don't, there's no absolutes here. Someone could absolutely knock his socks off. I don't think anyone will. I think he'll make the pick. The bigger question is whether he takes a defenseman in Ryan Murray or whether he takes Neil Yakupov, the winger. But this is the final day of an opening phase of a rebuild, guys, that you can't blow it. Like, you've gone through all this pain to get this pick. You can't all of a sudden hit the fast forward button and use this pick to try to speed up a process. I think everyone in Toronto has seen what happens when you promise an expedited or an expedited rebuild. You can't, that's a contradiction in terms. You can't speed it up. So I've got no problem with the Oilers their last two seasons. They've been a lousy team. They've built up draft picks. That's good. Don't go through those 2 years, though, and then all of a sudden try to speed things up and waste the patient work that you've done.
The Edmonton Oilers down the road are going to have to deal with some of these young kids and long-term contracts. The Pittsburgh Penguins are experiencing the long-term contract headache right now with Sidney Crosby. The talk on CBC this weekend was a 10-year deal worth $9 million annually. What are your thoughts on Sidney Crosby getting that kind of deal?
Oh, it is so tough for the Pittsburgh Penguins because, frankly, if he hasn't had any concussion problems, you just give him whatever you give him and away you go.
Right.
Because he's the best player in the league. But Sidney Crosby, as much as we all hate to say it here, it isn't the same Sidney Crosby anymore. You know, so what are we paying? You know, when you negotiate terms for Sid Crosby's future, he's still the face of your franchise. The Penguins are morally obligated to sign him. They have to sign him and keep him. But what scale are we paying him on, gentlemen? Are we paying him on Sidney Crosby of the last 6-7 years? Are we paying him on Sidney Crosby of the next 6-7 years? And those are two different pay scales, I suspect.
It's you're right, Speck, and I think this is going to be one of those old school signings where, and you know this from covering the game as long as you have, you pay a player for what he's done, not for what he's going to do. And a lot of that franchise now and that barn was built on the back of Sidney Crosby. This to me sounds like and feels like, hey Sid, this is our contract thanking you for what you've done for this franchise since you came into the league.
Why can't the Pittsburgh Penguins try to make a little bit of a Ray Bourque cap here, of a Sedin Twins cap, right? The Vancouver Canucks salary structure works on the fact that the Sedin Twins were convinced and were professional, and I respect the fact that they agreed that if we make a little less, the guys under us will all make a little less, and we can get more talent in this lineup under the cap system. Why does Sid need to make 9, right? Maybe Sid makes, 7. What about that?
He's just trying to make ends meet. Well, that's one part of it too, but let's not forget, two more seasons, then you have the same situation, although you're probably dealing with a healthier hockey player with Evgeny Malkin.
Well, look, I mean, we started with the Oilers. Let's go back there. I hear this out there in the hockey world. Oh, the Oilers, they got Eberle, and they got Hall, and they got Nugent Hopkins, and they got this new kid they're about to draft, whoever he is, and oh, they're going to be in trouble. Well, isn't that a nice problem to have, having too many talented hockey players to fit under your cap? Like, let's cross these bridges when we get to them. Would the Toronto Maple Leafs like to have that problem right now? I suspect they would. So, Pittsburgh's got trouble. They got two of the greatest players in the game. I mean, and Jordan Staal underneath of that. But those are problems that you don't mind having. I'd rather have Ray Shiro's problems than Scott Housen's problems right now.
Well, Edmonton doesn't really have problems if you're Glenn Sather, because you know you're going to end up with at least four of those players in a couple of years on the Rangers. Speck, you have correctly, sir, noted that the Los Angeles Kings, what the once near coronation Los Angeles Kings, should be feeling all the pressure in the world as the plucky, clutch New Jersey Devils, led by their ageless goaltender and soon-to-be Conn Smythe winner Marty Brodeur, rally to make history in this series. How much pressure are the Kings under, knowing their demise is inevitable?
I have not noted any of those things, but you know them very well. Listen, I'm just thinking today, this is the third occasion now where the Los Angeles Kings have come to a morning skate looking ahead to a day that could put a Stanley Cup ring on their finger. So they blew it the first time. Too many distractions and they didn't win. They didn't even play that well. They went to New Jersey, played. I felt they had more and better scoring chances. They lose the game 2-1. Stuff happens. Now they're back with a third chance. They've refined this process. It's not new to them anymore. You guys tell me this. What's harder? Is it harder to win the fourth game when you're up 3-0? The fourth one's always the toughest to win. That's what every hockey player tells us. Or is it harder to deny a group of guys a Stanley Cup for four consecutive nights in a row when it's sitting right there in front of them? You might do it once, you might do it twice.
Yeah.
I don't think that the New Jersey Devils can deny this group of Los Angeles Kings four times. I don't think anyone can do it.
Yeah, it's even a lot of the refrain after the weekend was, it's nice that New Jersey got the two wins, but show me that Jonathan Quick and this team is going to lose four games in a row. Although, you know what, and I'm sure this is getting some play, Speck, this isn't exactly new territory tonight specifically for Daryl Sutter. If we go back to 2004, it was a Calgary Flames team led by Daryl Sutter that took a 3-2 series lead into the Saddle Dome against the Tampa Bay Lightning and ended up losing in seven games.
They did. I mean, and I think the head coach is the only place you can make a correlation there. I think I covered that series. And, you know, the Calgary Flames were outgunned. They had a better goalie, I think, Kiprusoff. Not much, because Happy Boulin was in his prime. But they were playing defensemen out of the AHL, and one guy out of the ECHL, as I recall. They couldn't match, you know, they had Iginla, but they couldn't match up with Le Cavalier at his best, and Richards, and Saint-Louis. They didn't have as good a team, you know. This is different. Los Angeles has every bit as good a team. They've got every bit as good a goalie. They're not injured. They're not beat up. They got all their bullets. Calgary didn't have their bullets. I'm not saying this is an excuse, but I thought Tampa was the better team in that series, and they won it. I don't think that's the case here.
Speck, last one for me. You're a respected veteran member of the Professional Hockey Writers Association.
Yes.
Do you think there is a chance, outside that it is, if Marty Brodeur pitches a shutout in Game 6 and then, say, loses 1-0 in a Game 7 where he is equal to or better than Jonathan Quick, that he could Jaguar this thing, Hextall this thing, potentially win the Conn Smythe in a losing effort?
I guess the potential is there. I am not voting this year, so I can speak without tipping my hand. But, you know, the funny, I think it's a fallback to always give, not always, but the Conn Smythe goes to goaltenders, in my opinion, sometimes when they don't deserve it. This playoff season, however, as low scoring as it's been, a goalie's going to win this thing either way. There's no doubt in my mind. I have a hard time thinking in a series that has had what? How many 2-1 games in this series? We've played five. Have three of them been 2-1? And the fourth had a empty net goal that made it 3-1, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm correct in that. So
yeah, I believe so.
Four 2-1 games, guys. I mean, does that mean that Brodeur is better than Quick? Does that mean Quick's better than Brodeur? Is one guy, has Brodeur, if your question is, has Brodeur been so much better than Quick that he can come out as the losing goalie and win the Conn Smythe? My answer is no, because he hasn't been any better than Quick. He's in fact had a lot more goal pulls.
You have to take into account that Marty is fatter than Quick, and carrying all that extra weight, he
is
able to perform just as well as Quick.
He's a better story. And I'll be brutally frank with you, he's a nicer guy to deal with.
And Speck, you know, honestly, to be serious for a second here, Jaguar won in 2003 because he was the better story. Like, he had an amazing run to the final. He didn't play all that well in the final. And then it was his story, the stuff with his mom, everything else, coming out of nowhere, leading this underdog team. I mean, the story was the story combined with the fact that neither Brodeur nor Niedermeyer really had that outstanding a run in the playoffs for the Devils was the reason he won. But the narrative was there for Jaguar, and I still think that's why he won in 2003.
Wish is still better, Speck, that it was Jaguar. But Speck, as wise in hockey people as we are, yourself and me, we know that if it wasn't going to be Jaguar, it was going to be either Keith Carney or Ruslan Soleil. So he can take all of his New Jersey dreams and get rid of them. Who's been the best player, either forward or defenseman, in this series?
The best player in this series, gosh, when there's no one scoring any goals, you tell me. You know, I really like Justin Williams' game. Ilya Kovalchuk is injured and he can't fulfill the role of being the best player in the series. Zach Parise's banging away and nothing's going in for him. Made a nice play on Quick's mistake. I'll be clear with you. I don't have an answer for who the best player is because there's not enough goals. Rob Scuderi? I don't know. You tell me who the best player is.
Drew Doughty for me, or are you making an outside case for Bryce Salvador?
We'll
let you get back to it. Thanks so much for dropping by today.
All right, boys, my pleasure.
There he is, Mark Spector. You can read him at sportsnet.ca, also on our Sportsnet West broadcast. Handles some of the work for the Edmonton Oilers, who today made
out in Los Angeles to see the Devils extend the series tonight.
Yeah. And to watch Gene Principe wear shorts.
Oh. Well, that's worth the price of admission.
Well, see, here's the thing. Speck's a pro. He does all of his stand-ups in pants. And there's Gene wearing the shorts.
Interesting story out of Philadelphia today. Howard Eskin, who's not exactly a fountain of accurate information, he's a radio host. He's kind of a controversy guy. If he wore sunglasses, maybe he'd remind you of somebody in Toronto. But he reported today that James Van Riemsdyk was holding back from having surgery, trying to delay it as long as he could to somehow delay the Flyers trading him to Columbus for Rick Nash in a package.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that one. And Paul Holmgren has already come out and shot that down, correct?
Yeah,
that's Sarah Baker write about that.
I think that story on its face is ludicrous. That said, you're talking about a guy with, I think it's a $4.5 million cap hit. He's in a long-term deal. You're talking about a Flyers team that could give a goalie like Bobrovsky to the Blue Jackets in a package. If, like I said on the blog today, if I were Scott Housen, I go right in that room, look Holmgren in the face, arch one eyebrow, and go, Couturier.
Oh, yeah.
When asked exactly what I want in that package.
That's the thing. Like, when I heard this morning, James Van Riemsdyk was a very nice hockey player, and Sergei Bobrovsky, jury's still very much out. I say to myself, not enough for the caramel secret. Like, really? Like, you're not gonna rob Scott Housen. Like, he wanted Kreider and McDonough from New York.
Yeah.
You're not gonna throw back Bobrovsky and James Van Riemsdyk. It's not gonna get it done.
JVR is a good young player. He would be an attractive part of a package for Nash. True or false?
Absolutely. Part of a package.
But not the pivot.
But you're right. I'm saying Couturier. If I'm walking in there,
For sure.
We're playing poker. This ain't Pie Gal. If I
were Scott Housen, and I'd walk into that room and I would be like, you have something that's mine and I'd like it back.
Remember that pick in the Carter deal that you definitely turned into Sean Couturier, you prick? I would like that back now.
All right, listen, we have a special celebrity guest on the line, and please, everybody, withhold your jokes. He's on the golf course.
He is Bernie Parent. He is a 13-year NHL veteran, and he played a season in the World Hockey Association as well. He is the first player to successfully defend the Conn Smythe Trophy, and his mask, which he had ripped off his face in a famous Leafs-Rangers brawl in 1971 by Vic Hatfield, has been recovered. Bernie Parent joins us now. Bernie, thanks for joining us today, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm on the golf course having a beautiful time. Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for taking time away from your drives and your putts to talk a little bit of hockey with us. First of all, your thoughts when you found out that your mask had been rediscovered, placed on auction, and someone spent thousands of dollars to get it.
Hello?
Hello, Bernie, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I lost you a little bit, but okay. We're good now. Yes.
Okay, there we go, Brent. I'm just curious your thoughts when you found out that, you know, the mask that Vic Hatfield whipped into the stands at MSG in 71, found again, put up on auction, and someone paid thousands of dollars for. When did you find out, and what went through your mind?
Well, you know, when you think about it, that's, that's 40 years ago, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like almost like I had breakfast with Moses. It's been so long, you know. So, but you know, it was neat. It was neat, you know, because the mask disappeared, and of course, never heard about it until 4 years later. And then I had to identify the mask, and there were a couple of things that the mask, when I put it on, was because 40 years is a long time, you know. And I put it on. And you know, in the old days when they put the mask, they mold the mask to inside of your eye socket so you could see better. Mm-hmm. And it fit real well. And the sponges I put inside to absorb the shock. I'm the one who did that. It sure is, was a good feeling to see that mask. Yeah.
Bernie, did you think the guy was going to just give you? I mean, I read that story. I thought he was going to give you the mask.
Yeah.
Well, I think what he wants to do, I met him in Toronto a couple of days ago during the weekend, and I think he's thinking about putting the mask into the Hockey Hall of Fame. Isn't it great? Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful thing, though. The first thought that went through my mind, much like Greg's, is give Bernie his mask back. Bernie, would you like to have
Bernie
this thing back?
Mask.
Yeah, but the was a lot of money because of the history of the mask. People paid a lot of money for this, so at the end of the day, somebody can benefit from something like this. God bless them, and let's move on. But it's nice to see the mask in circulation again in the right hands and at the right place. Yeah.
Now, one of the things about that brawl too, which was remarkable, because I was always under the impression, you know, learning later on that you guys were pretty good friends. Before Hatfield grabbed the mask, there's your alleged good buddy Ed Jockeman, who has you in a headlock.
Yeah, I know, and we are good buddies. And but you know, you get through the excitement of the brawl and the fight, and you had me by the headlock, you know, and I said, Eddie, you're choking me. Eddie, you're choking me.
I know. And hey, Bernie.
It was fun. Yeah, it was fun. But that's when Hatfield picked up the mask and threw him in the stand. It was, and then I look up and the mask just kept going up all the way to the last row. That was incredible.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Hey, Bernie. Playoffs this year, man. A 40-year-old Marty Brodeur. Doing it, getting it done for the Devils. Are you surprised at 40 that Marty Brodeur is doing this for New Jersey?
Well, you know, more than surprised. It's such a beautiful thing to have an individual with so much passion, you know, at 40, and that's the part that really impresses me. You know, the 40 years old and the passion that he has, and he's blessed with good genes. You know, he's still strong. And you see the way he's playing, you know, it's just a beautiful thing. He's broken all the records in National Hockey League, and I've seen a lot of good goalies in this league, you know, through all the years. And in my estimation, he's the best goalie ever played a game. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, Bernie, because here he is at 40 years of age, Stanley Cup final, and I don't think, considering now that the butterfly style is so prevalent in the NHL and it's very hard on the body to play that style, I don't think we see another 40-year-old netminder get this far in his career, let alone make it to the Stanley Cup. You were always considered the best angle goaltender of all time. No one played angles better than Bernie Parent. When you look at how Marty Brodeur plays, what comes to your mind, Bernie?
Well, Marty is not your typical butterfly goalie. You know, he's he will dive in and do all kinds of things. You know, to what is required. You know, to make the save. But he, I saw him make a couple of saves on some breakaways, and he's I would say more like a 75% stand up and 25% on his knees, you know, once in a while. But most of the time, he's standing up. And I think when you really watch him play compared to the other goalies, it's just, you know, you see a big difference. For an example, Quick, you know, for the Kings, you know, he's it's just like a cat out there, you know. He's on his knees constantly. But, you know, the reason he is so good is because he gets up so fast, too. You know, he doesn't stay on his knees. He gets down to his knees, but then he bounces right back up again to follow the play. So two different styles, but yet very successful styles. But like you said, if you play, you know, your knees constantly, that has to shorten your career a little bit, definitely.
It certainly does. Hey, Bernie, we talked at the beginning of this interview about the brawl in 1971 and your mask vanishing. But 6 years prior to that, you were involved in, and I have a copy of the game, and I showed Greg this over the All-Star break in Ottawa, the 1965 Memorial Cup. That game three, Rickley and Ron Anderson kicked out for a stick swinging. Goldsworthy gets speared by Falkenberg. Falkenberg gets knocked out by Derek Sanderson. Cops hit the ice. You came in for Doug Favell in the second period. They're throwing eggs at you. They had to stop the game at different times to clean up the eggs. Now, I always found really interesting, at the other end of the ice for the Oil Kings was Wayne Stevenson, who later on you went to play it with the Philadelphia Flyers. A, right. What are your memories of that game, and did you and Stevenson ever talk about it?
Well, I think Sanderson had a great punch in that game.
Oh boy!
Just kidding. But yeah, but you know, we had a good hockey team. We really did. We were well balanced. We had a great coach, and you know what? The beauty about winning the Memorial Cup is that you only have maybe 2 or 3 years. And then after a certain age, I think it's 19 or 20, then you're out of it. So winning the Stanley Cup, winning that cup is you know, you have to be with the right team at the right time because you only have a couple of years to do it. And that was the and then, you know, it's funny. The ironic part is that the Niagara Falls. The team was the Flyers. Think about that one.
Yeah. And there you are with the Flyers again.
Last one for me, Bernie. What? Tell me about being Ron Hextall's goaltending coach. Is there any unique challenges in handling a goaltender who now and again could get a little temperamental?
Well, that is. But, Ron, when you look at this career, they're just the... it'd be a beautiful thing if the Kings would win. You know, when you look at the Flyer like this, that was so close. He made it to the finals twice, with the Flyers, and, they just couldn't get it done. You know, the one time they played against Edmonton, which is, you know, just such a power, house. You know, then the second time was against Detroit, was, also, a very, a great team. So, you know, but he, you know what, the way he handled the puck, the way he, his enthusiasm, you know, the way he approached the games, just incredible the way he played. It was a very exciting player to watch. As a matter of fact, you know, it reminded me of when Favell played, Doug Favell. You know, Favell was a very good goalie and very exciting goaltender. In my case, I was a boring goalie. He just played the angle. You know?
Yeah, no kidding. So boring. You won 2 Stanley Cups and 2 Conn Smythe trophies in the process. Listen, we'll let you get back to golf. Bernie, thanks so much for stopping by today to share some memories. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have fun, guys.
Take care. Bernie Perrant, legendary netminder, the Philadelphia Flyers. You know what's so interesting, Wish? And
what's that?
I've talked to people, and you've seen it. Like I was talking, we watched it together in Ottawa, and Sean Leahy has jaw hit the ground. Some of that trail mix fell out of his mouth. That brawl game in the Memorial Cup in 1965. I've talked to a couple of different players from that Niagara Falls Flyers team. Nobody wants to talk about it. Like, as you can see, like, Bernie, like, oh, yeah, you know, Hap M's our coach and a great team and happy to win the Memorial Cup. But no one actually ever really wants to, because that incident, like, that entire, it wasn't just that one moment before the cops hit the ice, but the entire game was just Brawlfield. The only guy that I've spoken to from that Niagara Falls team that has actually, you know, allowed himself to go back in his own mind and talk about that game was Rick Lee, who was pitched in the second period for a stick swinging incident. He's been the only guy. I remember talking to Derek Sanderson, and Derek has a book coming out next year, and I'm sure we'll get him on the podcast, and we'll see if he'll go back to that game. But I mean, that game was one of the most brutal games, I think, in the history of the sport.
It was,
and
like watching,
when
you showed it to me, it was like watching the videotape from The Ring. It was like your life has changed. You're worried about somebody coming and beating you up within 6 days.
Yeah, it's like this, and we complain about hockey now. Like, this is insanity on ice. This is ridiculous. And then the cops, it's just, but it's funny, you know, and I've talked to countless guys on both sides, on the Niagara Falls side and on the Edmonton side. Nobody wants to talk about it. It was just that horrific.
All right, question of the day was, what's your favorite comeback this season, 2011-2012 season in the NHL? Favorite comeback, Bane 35 for the question of the day, the art of throwing plastic rats on the ice. Now if only hot pennies found their way back. Scott McMenemy, David Perron coming back this season after his concussion was a pretty good comeback. A New Jersey season as a whole was also a great comeback after last year. That's accurate. This is G. Hall from Calgary, Alberta. I think it has to be the regular season and playoff performance of both the Panthers and the Senators. One was a put-together team with no hope. The other deemed a bottom feeder before the puck dropped. It's as if Gilbert and the Brooklyn Brawler became main event players during the Attitude Era. Wow.
Did we just have a Gilbert reference? Lombardi reference there? Wow, that's pretty hot. That's so good. Jeremy Ballaston, the Ottawa Senators, further to our last tweeter's point. Whole season was one big comeback from the third period comebacks, that's true, to making the playoffs. You know who also had that comeback kids vibe this year? And they took it in the playoffs as well in the first couple of games against the Penguins, the Philadelphia Flyers. Like, you look at how many third period comebacks the Flyers were part of. It was remarkable. But yeah, you're right. Jeremy Ballaston, bingo, put the Ottawa Senators top of that list.
Andy Brusso, my favorite comeback of the year is the impending return of the Creditors to the New Jersey Devils. Unfortunately for them, the Kings breaking the road wins record will render the record section of drywall in the dressing room completely worthless. This will prohibit them from raising the cash needed to sign Parise. These such bitter words for somebody who knows he's on the precipice of watching history be made. Griswold Ducktrance. Holy shit.
Great name.
QOD, Landeskog's first goal of the year went in off his rump and tied the game
butt.
In a comeback against the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Yeah, I remember the goal off the butt. And when he tells his grandkids, it's going to be, I went end-to-end, deeked through four guys, and went cheddar on the goaltender. No, it went off your ass, Grandpa.
Hey, by the way, a bit of editing to be done here on today's show. Peter Hassett and Top Rooman both write in, Pens are dealing with the long-term headache of Sidney Crosby. Was that pun intended once, Top Rooman?
Ooh,
to know? And Peter Hassett, you pay a player for what he's done rather than what he's going to do. Jeff Merrick, sometimes you have to.
I already tweeted him back when we were talking to Speck. I said that was the old school way of doing contracts. Because that really was. Oh, okay, he's 30 years old. We're going to pay him for the body of work. Now you can't do that in a salary cap era. That's death. Because now the body of payment is totally shifted. It used to be the old guys getting rewarded. Now it's you have to be a speculator. It's all the guys coming out of the ELC deals that ring the bell and end up getting the big buck contracts for what you think they will do.
Couple things real quick on the question of the day. I agree with Tom. This is a good one. Favorite comeback of the year. Cover your ears, Atlanta. Winnipeg Jets and seeing Timu receiving the recognition he deserves at the MTS Center. Completely agree. Franklin Tower fans
in Winnipeg. The comeback of the creative fan. Like really
Franklin
creative.
They were awesome. Totally. Franklin Tower, Dustin Brown for the post-trade rumors performance. Avoided having to move to Buffalo. Let's see here. Mike Ford, another good one. Bryce Salvador misses an entire season, comes back, plays all 105 games so far this year, and has been a repeated playoff hero. And finally, Mark Erickson, Reddit CBJ, comeback of the year, favorite comeback of the year.
This is a good one.
Does your effing irrelevant count for all of you 24/7 fans? And we'll leave it at that. All right.
Yes, it does.
Merrick's got a boogie.
Yes, it does. I gotta hustle.
We've got, of course, tonight. Would be game six. I will be watching it, doing the live blog. If things don't go the Devil's way, I can't even conceive that happening. Then we'll be obviously covering the hell out of this thing with Puck Daddy tonight.
What kind of God would allow that, Greg?
Now, keep in mind, this entire show was all hubris on my part because I vowed to you that if the Devils won Game 5, I would come back and be fanboy on Monday, and it's been done. Do I think they're going to win the cup? Honestly, do I think they're going to win the cup? Honestly, I don't know. I still think that history, the percentages, and the fact that they were very fortunate on the bad puck luck of the Los Angeles Kings in the last two games would mean they're not going to win the cup. That said, there's been something about this team that's just been special, would you say?
You know,
so there's a part of me that's believing it right now, and I don't know why.
Two summers ago, I taught for 2 weeks at a hockey camp in northern Israel in Matula, and we made one of our voyages down to Jerusalem, and I found this nice little shop, and I had some hubris. It was really nice, but what the guy did is he had the hubris base, and then he drizzled hot oil on it, and then spread the pine nuts on top, so they exploded on the hubris itself and really brought out the flavor. We had it on pita.
On that note... I am Greg Wyshynski, Yahoo Sports.
I'm an idiot, and I'm working tonight on Hockey Central with Doug McLean and Nick Kiprios. Check us out at 11 o'clock Eastern on Sportsnet.
Thanks to a legendary goaltender by the name of Bernie Perron, who joined us from the golf course. Flyers, yes. Golf course.
Were you impressed that I didn't get too geeky with him?
You towed the line. It's funny, over Instant Messenger during the show, we were having a debate whether or not this would be the first interview in which Merrick knows more about a player's career than the player.
There is one question I was like, oh man, I can't ask this, but I've always wondered about it, from that 1965 Niagara Falls Flyers team, because Bernie wore number 30 on the squad, but on the team photo, he's wearing number 24.
Oh man. Mr. Shatner, in episode 13 of Star Trek.
That's what it was. Exactly what I was thinking, too.
You were fighting the Gorn, why didn't you just use the phaser to remodulate
them? I can't be that guy. That's what I was thinking. Thanks, everybody, for joining us for the show today. So tomorrow, once again, it'll be either sad wish day or happy wish day. Yeah. And you'll either be opening the show with a funeral march set to the highlights of Game 6 and the Devils' elimination.
No, dude.
Or it will open the show with another dose of Greg Wyshynski whimsy at the expense of the Los Angeles Kings as they piss in the wind of history.
So, dude, but Elena has the two choicest songs picked out. She's been scheming this since Adam Enrique iced the New York Rangers. She's had the two songs picked out, and they are... Don't bother tweeting it, folks, because Elena has nailed it. These are perfect.
Perfect. All right, very good.
These are right.
All right, aces. All right, thanks, everybody. We will see you tomorrow. Bye.
Game 6. Yeah, yeah, bye. I think at the end. Bye.